line between civilian and criminal. We like to believe we live in a world of good guys and bad guys. And in the suburbs, it's easy to believe that, because getting to know a career criminal in the suburbs is a difficult thing. But then you go to the hood, and you see there are so many shades in between. In the hood, gangsters were your friends and neighbors. You knew them. You talked to them on the corner, saw them at parties. They were a part of your world. You knew them from before they became gangsters. It wasn't, "Hey, that's a crack dealer." It was, "Oh, little Jimmy's selling crack now." The weird thing about these gangsters was that they were all, at a glance, identical. They drove the same red sports car. They dated the same beautiful 18-year-old girls. It was strange. It was like they didn't have personalities. They shared a personality. One could be the other, and the other could be the one. They'd each studied how to be that gangster. In the hood, even if you're not a hardcore criminal, crime is in your life in some way or another. There are degrees of it. It's everyone from the mom buying some food that fell off the back of a truck to feed her family, all the way up to the gangs selling military-grade weapons and hardware. The hood made me realize that crime succeeds because crime does the one thing the government doesn't do. Crime cares. Crime is grassroots. Crime looks for the young kids who need support and a lifting hand. Crime offers internship programs and summer jobs and opportunities for advancement. Crime gets involved in the community. Crime doesn't discriminate. My life of crime started off small, selling pirated CDs on the corner. That in itself was a crime. And today I feel like I owe all these artists money for stealing their music. But by hood standards, it didn't even qualify as illegal. At the time, it never occurred to any of us that we were doing anything wrong. If copying CDs is wrong, why would they make CD writers? The garage of Bongani's house opened up onto Springbok Crescent. Every morning, we'd open up the doors, run an extension cord out into the street, set up a table, and play music. People would walk by and ask, "What's that? Can I get one, please?" Our corner was also where a lot of minibus drivers ended their routes and turned around to loop back to the minibus rank. They'd swing by, place an order, come back, pick it up. Swing by, place an order, come back, pick it up. We spent our whole day running out to them, going back to the garage to make more mixes, and going back out to sell. There was a converted shipping container around the corner where we'd hang out when we got tired of the wall. It had a payphone installed inside that we'd use to call people. When things were slow, we'd wander back and forth between the container and the wall, talking and hanging out with the other people with nothing to do in the middle of the day. We'd talk to drug dealers, talk to gangsters. Every now and then, the cops would come crashing through. A day in the life of the hood. Next day, same thing. Selling slowly evolved into hustling, because Bongani saw all the angles and knew how to exploit them. Like Tom, Bongani was a hustler. But where Tom was only about the short con, Bongani had schemes. If we do this, we get that. Then we can flip that for the other thing, which gives us the leverage we need to get something bigger. Some minibus drivers couldn't pay up front, for example. "I don't have the money because I've just started my shift," they'd say. "But I need new music. Can I owe you guys some form of credit? I'll owe you a ride. I'll pay you at the end of my shift, at the end of the week." So we started letting drivers buy on credit, charging them a bit of interest. We started making more money. Never more than a few hundred, maybe 1,000 rand at a time. But it was all cash on hand. Bongani was quick to realize the position we were in. Cash is the one thing everyone in the hood needs. Everyone's looking for a short-term loan for something, to pay a bill, or pay a fine, or just hold things together. People started coming to us and asking for money. Bongani would cut a deal and then he'd come to me. "Yo, we're going to make a deal with this guy. We're going to loan him 100 and he's going to give us back 120 at the end of the week." I'd say, "Okay." Then the guy would come back and give us 120 rand. Then we did it again. Then we did it some more. We started to double our money, then triple our money. Cash gave us leverage in the hood's barter economy as well. It's common knowledge that if you're standing at a corner of a main street in the hood, somebody's gonna try to sell you something. Yo, 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 my man, you want some weed? You wanna buy a VCR? You wanna buy a DVD player? Yo, I'm selling a TV. That's just how it works. Let's say we see two guys haggling on the corner. A crackhead trying to sell a DVD player and some working dude who wants it but doesn't have the money because he hasn't got his wages yet. They're going back and forth, but the crackhead wants the money now. Crackheads don't wait. There's no layaway plan with a crackhead. So Bongani steps in and takes the working guy aside. Look, I understand you can't pay for the DVD player now, Bongani says. But how much are you willing to pay for it? I'll pay 120, he says. Okay, cool. Then Bongani takes the crackhead aside. How much do you want for the DVD player?
I want 140.
Okay, listen, you're a crackhead. This is a stolen DVD player. I'm gonna give you 50. The crackhead protests a bit, but then he takes the money because he's a crackhead and it's cash and crack is all about the now. Then Bongani goes back to the working guy. All right, we'll do 120. Here's your DVD player. It's yours.
But I don't have the 120.
It's cool. You can take it now. Only instead of 120, you give us 140 when you get your wages.
Okay.
So now we've invested 50 rand with the crackhead, and that gets us 140 from the working guy. But Bongani would see a way to flip it and grow it again. Let's say this guy who bought the DVD player worked at a shoe store. How much do you pay for a pair of Nikes with your staff discount? Bongani would ask.
I can get a pair of Nikes for 150.
Okay, instead of you giving us 140, we'll give you 10 and you get us a pair of Nikes with your discount. So now, this guy's walking away with a DVD player and 10 rand in his pocket. He's feeling like he got a good deal. He brings us the Nikes, and then we go to one of the cheesier cheese boys up in East Bank, and we say, yo, dude, we know you want the new Jordans. They're 300 in the shops. We'll sell them to you for 200. We sell him the shoes, and now we've gone and turned 60 rand into 200. That's the hood. Someone's always buying, someone's always selling, and the hustle is about trying to be in the middle of the whole thing. None of it was legal. Nobody knew where anything came from. The guy who got us Nikes, did he really have a staff discount? You don't know. You don't ask. It's just, hey, look what I found. And cool, how much do you want? That's the international code. At first, I didn't know not to ask. I remember one time we bought a car stereo or something like that. But who did this belong to? I said.
Hey, don't worry about it, one of the guys told me. White people have insurance.
Insurance?
Yeah. When white people lose stuff, they have insurance policies that pay them cash for what they've lost. So it's like they've lost nothing.
Oh, okay, I said. Sounds nice. And that was as far as we ever thought about it. When white people lose stuff, they get money. Just another nice perk of being white. It's easy to be judgmental about crime when you live in a world wealthy enough to be removed from it. But the hood taught me that everyone has different notions of right and wrong, different definitions of what constitutes crime, and what level of crime they're willing to participate in. If a crackhead comes through and he's got a crate of cornflakes boxes he's stolen out of the back of a supermarket, the poor mom isn't thinking, I'm aiding and abetting a criminal by buying these cornflakes. No, she's thinking, my family needs food, and this guy has cornflakes, and she buys the cornflakes. My own mother, my super religious, law-abiding mother, who used to shit on me about breaking the rules and learning to behave. I'll never forget one day I came home, and in the kitchen was a giant box of frozen burger patties, like 200 of them from a takeaway place called Blacksteer. A burger at Blacksteer cost at least 20 rand. What the hell is this? I said. Oh, some guy at work had these and was selling them, she said. I got a great discount. But where did he get it from?
I don't know. He said he knew somebody who...
Mom, he stole it.
We don't know that. We do know that.
Where the hell is some guy going to get all of these burger patties from randomly?
Of course, we ate the burgers.
Then we thanked God for the meal.
When Bongani first said to me, let's go to the hood, I thought we were going to sell CDs and DJ parties in the hood. It turned out that we were selling CDs and DJing parties in order to capitalize a payday lending and pawn shop operation in the hood. Very quickly, that became our core business. Every day in the hood was the same. I'd wake up early. Bongani would meet me at my flat, and we'd catch a minibus to Alex with my computer, carrying the giant tower and the giant heavy monitor the whole way. We'd set it up in Bongani's garage and start the first batch of CDs. Then we'd walk. We'd go down to the corner of 19th and Roosevelt for breakfast. When you're trying to stretch your money, food is where you have to be careful. You have to plan, or you'll eat your profits. So every morning for breakfast, we eat fetkoek, which is fried dough, basically. Those were cheap, like 50 cents a pop. We could buy a bunch of those and have enough energy to sustain us until later on in the day. Then we'd sit on the corner and eat. While we ate, we'd be picking up orders from the minibus drivers as they went past. After that, we'd go back to Bongani's garage, listen to music, lift weights, make the CDs. Around 10 or 11, the drivers would start coming back from their morning routes. We'd take the CDs and head out to the corner for them to pick up their stuff. Then we'd just be on the corner, hanging out, meeting characters, seeing who came by, seeing where the day was going to take us. A guy needs this. A guy is selling that. You never knew what it was going to be. There was always a big rush of business at lunch. We'd be all over Alexandra, hitting different shops and corners, making deals with everyone. We'd get free rides from the minibus drivers because we'd hop in with them and use it as an opportunity to talk about what music they needed. But secretly, we were riding with the guy for free. Hey, we want to collect orders. We'll talk to you while you drive. What do you need? What music are you looking for? Do you need the new Maxwell? Okay, we got the new Maxwell. Okay, we'll talk to you later. We'll jump out here. Then we'd hop on another ride, going wherever we were going next. After lunch, business would die down, and that's when we'd get our lunch, usually the cheapest thing we could afford, like a smiley with some maize meal. A smiley is a goat's head. They're boiled and covered with chili pepper. We call them smileys because when you're done eating all the meat off of it, the goat looks like it's smiling at you from the plate. The cheeks and the tongue are quite delicious, but the eyes are disgusting. They pop in your mouth. You put the eyeball into your mouth and you bite it, and it's just a ball of pus that pops. It has no crunch. It has no chew. It has no flavor that is appetizing in any way. After lunch, we'd head back to the garage, relax, sleep off the meal, and make more CDs. In the afternoons, we'd see a lot of moms. Moms loved us. They were some of our best customers. Since moms run the household, they're the ones looking to buy that box of soap that fell off the back of the truck. And they were more likely to buy it from us than from some crackhead. Dealing with crackheads is unpleasant. We were upstanding, well-spoken East Bank boys. We could even charge a premium because we added that layer of respectability to the transaction. Moms are also often the most in need of short-term loans to pay for this or that for the family. Again, they'd rather deal with us than with some gangster loan shark. Moms knew we weren't going to break anyone's legs if they couldn't pay. We didn't believe in that. Also, we weren't capable of it. Let's not forget that part. But that's where Bongani's brilliance came in. He always knew what a person could provide pending their failure to pay. We made some of the craziest trades. Moms in the hood are protective of their daughters, especially if their daughters are pretty. In Alex, there were girls who got locked up. They went to school, came straight home, and went straight into the house. They weren't allowed to leave. Boys weren't allowed to talk to them, weren't even allowed to hang around the house, none of that. Some guy was always going on about some locked away girl.
She's so beautiful. I'll do anything to get with her.
But he couldn't. Nobody could. Then that mom would need a loan. Once we lent her the money, until she paid us back, she couldn't chase us away from her house. We'd go by and hang out, chat, make small talk. The daughter would be right there, but the mom wouldn't say, "Don't talk to these boys." The loan gave us access to establish a relationship with the mom. We'd get invited to stay for dinner. Once the mom knew we were nice, upstanding guys, she'd agree to let us take her daughter to a party, as long as we promised to get her home safely. So then, we'd go to the guy who'd been so desperate to meet the daughter. "Hey, let's make a deal. We'll bring the girl to your party, and you get to hang out with her. How much can you give us?"
"I don't have money," he'd say, "but I have some cases of beer."
"Okay, so tonight we're going to this party. You give us 2 cases of beer for the party."
"Cool."
Then we'd go to the party. We'd invite the girl, who was usually thrilled to escape her mother's prison. The guy would bring the beer. He'd get to hang out with the girl. We'd write off the mom's debt to show her our gratitude, and we'd make our money back selling the beer. There was always a way to make it work. And often, that was the most fun part. Working the angles, solving the puzzle, seeing what goes where, who needs what, whom we can connect with who can then get us the money. At the peak of our operation, we probably had around 10,000 rand in capital. We had loans going out and interest coming in. We had our stockpile of Jordans and DVD players we'd bought to resell. We'd also had to buy blank CDs, hire minibuses to go to all our DJ gigs, feed 5 guys 3 times a day. We kept track of everything on the computer. Having lived in my mom's world, I knew how to do spreadsheets. We had a Microsoft Excel document laid out, everybody's name, how much they owed, when they paid, when they didn't pay. After work was when business started to pick up. Minibus drivers picking up 1 lost order, men coming home from work. The men weren't looking for soap and cornflakes. They wanted the gear. DVD players, CD players, PlayStation games. More guys would come through selling stuff too, because they'd been out hustling and stealing all day. There'd be a guy selling a cell phone, a guy selling some leather jackets, a guy selling shoes. There was this one dude who looked like a black version of Mr. Burns from The Simpsons. He'd always come by at the end of his shift with the most random, useless crap, like an electric toothbrush without the charger. One time, he brought us an electric razor.
"What the hell is this?"
"It's an electric razor."
"An electric razor? We're black. Do you know what these things do to our skin? Do you see anyone around here who can use an electric razor?" We never knew where he was getting this stuff from, because you don't ask. Eventually, we pieced it together, though. He worked at the airport. It was all the crap he was boosting from people's luggage. Slowly, the rush would start to taper off, and we'd wind down. We'd make our last collections, go over our CD stock, balance our accounts. If there was a party to DJ that night, we'd start getting ready for that. Otherwise, we'd buy a few beers and sit around and drink, talk about the day, listen to the gunshots in the distance. Gunshots went off every night, and we'd always try to guess what kind of gun it was. That's a 9mm. Usually, there'd be a police chase. Cop cars flying through after some guy with a stolen car. Then, everyone would go home for dinner with their families. I'd take my computer, get back in a minibus, ride home, sleep, and then come back and do it all again the next day. A year passed. Then 2. I had stopped planning for school and was no closer to having the money to enroll. The tricky thing about the hood is that you're always working, 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 and you feel like something's happening. But rarely, nothing's happening at all. I was out there every day from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And every day it was, how do we turn 10 rand into 20? How do we turn 20 into 50? How do I turn 50 into 100? At the end of the day, we'd spend it on food and maybe some beers. And then we'd go home and come back and it was, how do we turn 10 into 20? How do we turn 20 into 50? It was a whole day's work to flip that money. You had to be walking, be moving, be thinking. You had to get to a guy, find a guy, meet a guy. There were many days we'd end up back at zero, but I always felt like I'd been very productive. Hustling is to work what surfing the internet is to reading. If you add up how much you read in a year on the internet, tweets, Facebook, posts, lists, you've read the equivalent of a shit ton of books. But in fact, you've read no books in a year. When I look back on it, that's what hustling was. It's maximal effort put into minimal gain. It's a hamster wheel. If I put all that energy into studying, I'd have earned an MBA. Instead, I was majoring in hustling, something no university would give me a degree for. When I first went into Alex, I was drawn by the electricity and the excitement of it. But more important, I was accepted there, more so than I'd been in high school or anywhere else. When I first showed up, a couple of people raised an eyebrow. Who is this colored kid? But the hood doesn't judge. If you want to be there, you can be there. Because I didn't live in the hood, I was technically an outsider in the hood. But for the first time in my life, I didn't feel like one. The hood is also a low-stress, comfortable life. All your mental energy goes into getting by, so you don't have to ask yourself any of the big questions. Who am I? Who am I supposed to be? Am I doing enough? In the hood, you can be a 45-year-old man living in your mom's house asking people for money, and it's not looked down on. You never feel like a failure in the hood, because someone's always worse off than you. And you don't feel like you need to do more, because the biggest success isn't that much higher than you either. It allows you to exist in a state of suspended animation. The hood has a wonderful sense of community to it as well. Everyone knows everyone, from the crackhead all the way through to the policeman. People take care of one another. The way it works in the hood is that if any mom asks you to do something, you have to say yes. "Can I send you?" is the phrase. It's like everyone's your mom and you're everyone's kid. "Can I send you?" "Yeah, what do you need?" "I need you to go buy milk and bread." "Yeah, cool." Then she gives you some money and you go buy milk and bread. As long as you aren't busy and it doesn't cost you anything, you don't say no. The biggest thing in the hood is that you have to share. You can't get rich on your own. You have money? Why aren't you helping people? The old lady on the block needs help. Everyone pitches in. You're buying beer? You buy for everyone. You spread it around. Everyone must know that your success benefits the community in one way or another, or you become a target. The township polices itself as well. If someone is caught stealing, the township deals with them. If someone's caught breaking into a house, the township deals with them. If you're caught raping a woman, pray to God the police find you before the township does. If a woman is being hit, people don't get involved. There are too many questions with a beating. What's the fight about? Who's responsible? Who started it? But rape is rape. Theft is theft. You've desecrated the community. The hood was strangely comforting, but comfort can be dangerous. Comfort provides a floor, but also a ceiling. In our crew, our friend G was like the rest of us, unemployed, hanging out. Then he got a job at a nice clothing store. Every morning, he went to work, and the guys would tease him about going to work. We'd see him headed out all dressed up, and everyone would be laughing at him. "Oh, G, look at you in your fancy clothes. Oh, G, going to see the white man today, huh? Oh, G, don't forget to bring some books back from the library." One morning, after a month of G working at the place, we were hanging out on the wall, and G came out in his slippers and his socks. He wasn't dressed for work. "Yo, G, what's going on? What's up with the job?" "Oh, I don't work there anymore." "Why?" "They accused me of stealing something and I got fired." And I'll never forget thinking to myself that it felt like he did it on purpose. He sabotaged himself so that he'd get accepted back into the group again. The hood has a gravitational pull. It never leaves you behind, but it also never lets you leave. Because by making the choice to leave, You're insulting the place that raised you and made you and never turned you away. And that place fights you back. As soon as things start going well for you in the hood, it's time to go. Because the hood will drag you back in. It will find a way. There'll be a guy who steals a thing and puts it in your car and the cops find it. Something. You can't stay. You think you can. You'll start doing better. And you'll bring your hood friends out to a nice club. And the next thing you know, somebody starts a fight. And one of your friends pulls a gun and somebody's getting shot. And you're left standing around going, what just happened? The hood happened. One night, I was DJing a party. Not in Alex, but right outside Alex in Lombardy East. A nicer, middle-class black neighborhood. The police were called about the noise. They came busting in, wearing riot gear and pointing machine guns. That's how our police roll. We don't have small and then big. What Americans call SWAT is just our regular police. They came looking for the source of the music, and the music was coming from me. This one cop came over to where I was with my computer and pulled this massive assault rifle on me. You gotta shut this down right now! Okay, I said. I'm shutting it down. But I was running Windows 95. Windows 95 took forever to shut down. I was closing windows, shutting down programs. I had one of those fat Seagate drives that damaged easily, and I didn't want to cut the power and possibly damage the drive. This cop clearly didn't give a fuck about any of that. Shut it down! Shut it down! I am shutting it down. I have to close the programs. The crowd was getting angry, and the cop was getting nervous. He turned his gun away from me and shot the computer. Only, he clearly didn't know anything about computers because he shot the monitor. The monitor exploded, but the music kept playing. Now there was chaos, music blaring and everyone running and panicking because of the gunshots. I yanked the power cord out of the tower to shut the thing down. Then the cops started firing tear gas into the crowd. The tear gas had nothing to do with me or the music. Tear gas is just what the police use to shut down parties in black neighborhoods, like the club, turning on the lights to tell everyone to go home. I lost the hard drive. Even though the cops shot the monitor, the explosion somehow fried the thing. The computer would still boot up, but it couldn't read the drive. My music library was gone. Even if I'd had the money for a new hard drive, it had taken me years to amass the music collection. There was no way to replace it. The DJing business was over. The CD selling business was done. All of a sudden, our crew lost its main revenue stream. All we had left was the hustle, and we hustled even harder, taking the bit of cash we had on hand and trying to double it, buying this to flip it for that. We started eating into our savings, and in less than a month, we were running on dust. Then one evening after work, our friend from the airport, the black Mr. Burns, came by.
Hey, look what I found, he said.
What have you got?
A camera.
I'll never forget that camera. It was a digital camera. We bought it from him, and I took it and turned it on. It was full of pictures of a nice white family on vacation, and I felt like shit. The other things we'd bought had never mattered to me. Nikes, electric toothbrushes, electric razors, who cares? Yeah, some guy might get fired because of the pallets of cornflakes that went missing from the supermarkets, but that's degrees removed. You don't think about it. But this camera had a face. I went through those pictures, knowing how much my family pictures meant to me, and I thought, I haven't stolen a camera. I've stolen someone's memories. I've stolen part of someone's life. It's such a strange thing, but in 2 years of hustling, I never once thought of it as a crime. I honestly didn't think it was bad. It's just stuff people found. White people have insurance. Whatever rationalization was handy. In society, we do horrible things to one another because we don't see the person it affects. We don't see their face. We don't see them as people. Which was the whole reason the hood was built in the first place. To keep the victims of apartheid out of sight and out of mind. Because if white people ever saw black people as human, they would see that slavery is unconscionable. We live in a world where we don't see the ramifications of what we do to others because we don't live with them. It would be a whole lot harder for an investment banker to rip off people with subprime mortgages if he actually had to live with the people he was ripping off. If we could see one another's pain and empathize with one another, it would never be worth it to us to commit the crimes in the first place. As much as we needed the money, I never sold the camera. I felt too guilty, like it would be bad karma, which I know sounds stupid and it didn't get the family their camera back, but I just couldn't do it. That camera made me confront the fact that there were people on the other end of this thing I was doing, and what I was doing was wrong. One night, our crew got invited to dance in Soweto against another crew. Hitler was going to compete with their best dancer, Hector, who was one of the best dancers in South Africa at the time. This invitation was a huge deal. We were going over there, repping our hood. Alex and Soweto have always had a huge rivalry. Soweto was seen as the snobbish township, and Alexandra was seen as the gritty and dirty township. Hector was from Diepkloof, which was the nice, well-off part of Soweto. Diepkloof was where the first million-rand houses were built after democracy. "Hey, we're not a township anymore. We're building nice things now." That was the attitude. That's who we were up against. Hitler practiced a whole week. We took a minibus over to Diepkloof the night of the dance. Me and Bongani, Mzi and Beggy and G, and Hitler. Hector won the competition. Then G was caught kissing one of their girls, and it turned into a fight and everything broke down. On our way back to Alex, around 1 in the morning, as we were pulling out of Diepkloof to get onto the freeway, some cops pulled our minibus over. They made everyone get out, and they searched it. We were standing outside, lined up alongside the car, when one of the cops came back. "We found a gun," he said. "Whose gun is it?" We all shrugged. "We don't know," we said. "Nope, somebody knows. It's somebody's gun." "Officer, we really don't know," Bongani said. He slapped Bongani hard across the face. "You're bullshitting me." Then he went down the line, slapping each of us across the face, berating us about the gun. We couldn't do anything but stand there and take it. "You guys are trash," the cop said. "Where are you from?" "Alex." "Oh, okay, I see. Dogs from Alex. You come here and you rob people and you rape women and you hijack cars. Bunch of fucking hoodlums." "No, we're dancers. We don't know." "I don't care. You're all going to jail until we figure out whose gun this is." At a certain point, we realized what was going on. This cop was shaking us down for a bribe. Spot fine is the euphemism everyone uses. You go through this elaborate dance with the cop where you say the thing without saying the thing. "Can't we do something?" you ask the officer. "What do you want me to do?" "We're really sorry, officer. What can we do?" "You tell me." Then you're supposed to make up a story whereby you indicate to the cop how much money you have on you, which we couldn't do because we didn't have any money. So he took us to jail. It was a public bus. It could have been anyone's gun. But the guys from Alex were the only ones who got arrested. Everyone else in the car was free to go. The cops took us to the police station and threw us in a cell and pulled us out one by one for questioning. When they pulled me aside, I had to give my home address, Highlands North. The cop gave me the most confused look. "You are not from Alex," he said. "What are you doing with these crooks?" I didn't know what to say. He glared at me hard. "Listen here, rich boy. You think it's fun running around with these guys. This isn't play anymore. Just tell me the truth about your friends and the gun and I'll let you go." I told him no, and he threw me back in the cell. We spent the night, and the next day I called a friend who said he could borrow the money from his dad to get us out. Later that day, the dad came down and paid the money. The cops kept calling it bail, but it was a bribe. We were never formally arrested or processed. There was no paperwork. We got out, and everything was fine, but it rattled us. Every day, we were out in the streets, hustling, trying to act as if we were in some way down with the gangs. But the truth was, we were always more cheese than hood. We had created this idea of ourselves as a defense mechanism to survive in the world we were living in. Bongani and the other East Bank guys, because of where they were from, what they looked like, they just had very little hope. You've got two options in that situation. You take the retail job, flip burgers at McDonald's, if you're one of the lucky few who even gets that much. The other option is to toughen up, put up this facade. You can't leave the hood, so you survive by the rules of the hood. I chose to live in that world, but I wasn't from that world. If anything, I was an imposter. Day to day, I was in it as much as everyone else. But the difference was that in the back of my mind, I knew I had other options. I could leave. They couldn't. Once, when I was 10 years old, visiting my dad in Yeovil, I needed batteries for one of my toys. My mom had refused to buy me new batteries because, of course, she thought it was a waste of money. So I snuck out to the shops and shoplifted a pack. A security guard busted me on the way out, pulled me into his office and called my mom. "We've caught your son shoplifting batteries," he said. "You need to come and fetch him." "No," she said. "Take him to jail. If he's going to disobey, he needs to learn the consequences." Then she hung up. The guard looked at me confused. Eventually, he let me go on the assumption that I was some wayward orphan, because what mother would send her 10-year-old child to jail? 17. The world doesn't love you. My mom never gave me an inch. Anytime I got in trouble, it was tough love, lectures, punishment, and hidings. Every time, for every infraction. You get that with a lot of black parents. They're trying to discipline you before the system does. "I need to do this to you before the police do it to you." Because that's all black parents are thinking from the day you're old enough to walk out into the street where the law is waiting. In Alex, getting arrested was a fact of life. It was so common that out on the corner we had a sign for it, a shorthand, clapping your wrists together like you were being put in handcuffs. Everyone knew what that meant. "Where's Bongani?" "Wrist clap." "Oh shit, when?" "Friday night." "Damn." My mom hated the hood. She didn't like my friends there. If I brought them back to the house, she didn't even want them coming inside. "I don't like those boys," she'd say. She didn't hate them personally. She hated what they represented. "You and those boys get into so much shit," she'd say. "You must be careful who you surround yourself with, because where you are can determine who you are." She said the thing she hated most about the hood was that it didn't pressure me to become better. She wanted me to hang out with my cousin at his university. "What's the difference if I'm at university or I'm in the hood?" I'd say. "It's not like I'm going to university." "Yes, but the pressure of the university is going to get you. I know you. You won't sit by and watch these guys become better than you. If you're in an environment that is positive and progressive, you too will become that. I keep telling you to change your life and you don't. One day you're going to get arrested. And when you do, don't call me. I'll tell the police to lock you up just to teach you a lesson." Because there were some black parents who'd actually do that. Not pay their kids bail, not hire their kid a lawyer. The ultimate tough love. But it doesn't always work. Because you're giving the kid tough love when maybe he just needs love. You're trying to teach him a lesson, and now that lesson is the rest of his life. One morning, I saw an ad in the paper. Some shop was having a clearance sale on mobile phones, and they were selling them at such a ridiculous price, I knew Bongani and I could flip them in the hood for a profit. This shop was out in the suburbs, too far to walk and too out of the way to take a minibus. Fortunately, my stepfather's workshop and a bunch of old cars were in our backyard. I'd been stealing Abel's junkers to get around since I was 14.
I would say I was test driving them to make sure they'd been repaired correctly. Abel didn't think that was funny. I'd been caught many times, caught and subjected to my mother's wrath. But that had never stopped me from doing anything. Most of these junkers weren't street legal. They didn't have proper registrations or proper number plates. Luckily, Abel also had a stack of old number plates in the back of the garage. I quickly learned I could just put one on an old car and hit the road. I was 19, maybe 20, not thinking about any of the ramifications of this. I stopped by Abel's garage when no one was around, picked up one of the cars, the red Mazda I'd taken to the matric dance, slapped some old plates on it, and set off in search of discounted cell phones. I got pulled over in Hillbrow. Cops in South Africa don't give you a reason when they pull you over. Cops pull you over because they're cops and they have the power to pull you over. It's as simple as that. I used to watch American movies where cops would pull people over and say, "You didn't signal," or "Your tail light's out." I'd always wonder, why do American cops bother lying? One thing I appreciate about South Africa is that we have not yet refined the system to the point where we feel the need to lie. "Do you know why I pulled you over?" "Because you're a policeman and I'm a black person?" "That's correct. License and registration, please." When the cop pulled me over, it was one of those situations where I wanted to say, "Hey, I know you guys are racially profiling me." But I couldn't argue the case because I was, at that moment, actually breaking the law. The cop walked up to my window, asked me the standard cop questions. "Where are you going? Is this your car? Whose car is this?" I couldn't answer. I completely froze. Being young, funnily enough, I was more worried about getting in trouble with my parents than with the law. I'd had run-ins with the cops in Alexandra, in Soweto, but it was always more about the circumstance. A party getting shut down, a raid on a minibus. The law was all around me, but it had never come down on me, Trevor, specifically. And when you haven't had much experience with the law appears rational. Cops are dicks for the most part, but you also recognize that they're doing a job. Your parents, on the other hand, are not rational at all. They have served as judge, jury, and executioner for your entire childhood, and it feels like they give you a life sentence for every misdemeanor. In that moment, when I should have been scared of the cop, all I was thinking was, "Shit, shit, shit, I am in so much trouble when I get home." The cop called in the number plate registration and discovered that it didn't match the car. Now, he was really on my case. "This car is not in your name. What's going on with these plates? Step out of the vehicle." It was only then that I realized, oh shit, now I'm in real trouble. I stepped out of the car and he put the cuffs on me and told me I was being arrested on suspicion of driving a stolen vehicle. He took me in and the car was impounded. The Hillbrow police station looks exactly like every other police station in South Africa. They were all built by the same contractor at the height of apartheid, separate nodes in the central nervous system of a police state. If you were blindfolded and taken from one to the other, you probably wouldn't even know that you changed locations. They're sterile, institutional, with fluorescent lights and cheap floor tile, like a hospital. My cop walked me in and sat me down at the front booking desk. I was charged and fingerprinted. In the meantime, they'd been checking out the car, which wasn't going well for me either. Whenever I borrowed cars from Abel's workshop, I tried to take the junkers rather than a real client's car. I thought I'd get in less trouble that way. That was a mistake. The Mazda, being one of Abel's junkers, didn't have a clear title of ownership. If it had had an owner, the cops would have called the owner. The owner would have explained that the car had been dropped off for repairs, and the whole thing would have been sorted out. Since the car didn't have an owner, I couldn't prove I hadn't stolen it. Carjackings were common in South Africa at the time, too. So common, you weren't even surprised when they happened. You'd have a friend coming over for a dinner party, and you'd get a call. "Sorry, got carjacked, gonna be late." "Ah, that sucks. Hey, guys, Dave got carjacked." "Oh, sorry, Dave." And the party would continue.
And that's if the person survived the carjacking. Often, they didn't. People were getting shot for their cars all the time. Not only could I not prove I hadn't stolen the car, I couldn't prove I hadn't murdered someone for it either. The cops were grilling me. You kill anyone to get that car, boy? Huh? You a killer? I was in deep, deep trouble. I had only one lifeline. My parents. One call would have fixed everything. This is my stepfather. He's a mechanic. I borrowed his car when I shouldn't have. Done. At worst, I'd get a slap on the wrist for driving a car that wasn't registered. But what would I be getting at home? I sat there in the police station, arrested for suspicion of grand theft auto, a plausible suspect for carjacking or murder, and debated whether I should call my parents or go to jail. With my stepfather, I was thinking, he might actually kill me. In my mind, that was an entirely realistic scenario. With my mother, I was thinking, she's going to make this worse. She's not the character witness I want right now. She won't help me. Because she told me she wouldn't. If you ever get arrested, don't call me. I needed someone sympathetic to my plight, and I didn't believe she was that person. So I didn't call my parents. I decided I didn't need them. I was a man. I could go it alone. I used my call to phone my cousin and told him not to tell anyone what had happened while I figured out what to do. Now, I just had to figure out what to do. I'd been picked up late in the afternoon, so by the time I was processed, it was close to lights out. I was spending the night in jail, like it or not. It was at that point that a cop pulled me aside and told me what I was in for. The way the system works in South Africa is that you're arrested and held in a cell at the police station until your bail hearing. At the hearing, the judge looks at your case, hears arguments from the opposing sides, and then he either dismisses the charges or sets bail and a trial date. If you can make bail, you pay and go home. But there are all sorts of ways your bail hearing can go wrong. You get some court-appointed lawyer who hasn't read your case and doesn't know what's going on. Your family can't pay your bail. It could even be that the court's backed up. Sorry, we're too busy. No more hearings today. It doesn't matter the reason. Once you leave jail, you can't go back to jail. If your situation isn't resolved that day, you go to prison to await trial. In prison, you're housed with the people awaiting trial, not with the general population. But even the awaiting trial section is incredibly dangerous because you have people picked up for traffic violations all the way up to proper hardened criminals. You're stuck there together, and you can be there for days, weeks, maybe months. It's the same way in America. If you're poor, if you don't know how the system works, you can slip through the cracks. And the next thing you know, you're in this weird purgatory where you're not in prison, but you're not in prison. You haven't been convicted of any crime, but you're still locked up and can't get out. This cop pulled me aside and said, "Listen, you don't want to go to your bail hearing. They'll give you a state attorney who won't know what's going on. He'll have no time for you. He'll ask the judge for a postponement, and then maybe you'll go free, or maybe you won't. Trust me, you don't want to do that. You have the right to stay here for as long as you like. You want to meet with a lawyer and set yourself up before you go anywhere near a court or a judge." He wasn't giving me this advice out of the goodness of his heart. He had a deal with a defense attorney, sending him clients in exchange for a kickback. He handed me the attorney's business card. I called him, and he agreed to take my case. He told me to stay put while he handled everything. Now, I needed money, because lawyers, as nice as they are, don't do anything for free. I called a friend and asked him if he could ask his dad to borrow some money. He said he'd handle it. He talked to his dad, and the lawyer got his retainer the next day. With the lawyer taken care of, I felt like I had things under control. I was feeling pretty slick. I'd handled the situation, and most important, Mom and Abel were none the wiser. When the time came for lights out, a cop came and took my stuff. My belt, my wallet, my shoelaces. "Why do you need my shoelaces?"
"So you don't hang yourself."
"Right." Even when he said that, the gravity of my situation still wasn't sinking in. Walking to the station's holding cell, looking around at the other six guys in there, I was thinking, this is no big deal. Everything's going to be cool. I'm going to get out of this. I thought that right up until the moment the cell door clanged shut behind me and the guard yelled, "Lights out!" That's when I thought, oh shit, this is real. The guards had given me a mat and a scratchy blanket. I rolled them out on the concrete floor and tried to get comfortable. Every bad prison movie I'd ever seen was racing through my head. I'm thinking, I'm going to get raped. I'm going to get raped. I'm going to get raped. Of course I didn't get raped, because this wasn't prison. It was jail. And there's a big difference, as I would soon come to understand. I woke up the next morning with that fleeting sensation where you think something has all been a dream. Then I looked around and remembered that it wasn't. Breakfast came, and I settled in to wait. A day in jail is mostly silence, punctuated by passing guards shouting profanities at you, doing roll call. Inside the holding cell, nobody says anything. Nobody walks into a jail cell and says, "Hi guys, I'm Brian." Because everyone is afraid, and no one wants to appear vulnerable. Nobody wants to be the bitch. Nobody wants to be the guy getting killed. I didn't want anyone to know that I was just a kid in for a traffic charge. So I reached back in my mind for all the stereotypes of what I imagined people act like in prison. And then I tried to act like that. In South Africa, everyone knows that colored gangsters are the most ruthless, the most savage. It's a stereotype that's fed to you your whole life. The most notorious colored gangs are the numbers gangs, the 26s, the 27s, the 28s. They control the prisons. They are known for being brutally violent, maiming, torturing, raping, cutting off people's heads, not for the sake of making money, but just to prove how ruthless and savage they are, like Mexican drug cartels. In fact, a lot of these gangs base their thing on those Mexican gangs. They have the same look. The Converse All-Stars with the Dickies pants and the open shirt buttoned only at the top. By the time I was a teenager, any time I was profiled by cops or security guards, it usually wasn't because I was black, but because I looked colored. I went to a club once with my cousin and his friend. The bouncer searched Mlungisi, waved him in. He searched our friend, waved him in. Then he searched me and got up in my face. "Where's your knife?" "I don't have a knife." "I know you have a knife somewhere. Where is it?" He searched and searched and finally gave up and let me in, looking me over like I was trouble. "No shit from you, okay?" I figured that if I was in jail, people were going to assume I was the kind of colored person who ends up in jail, a violent criminal. So I played it up. I put on this character. I played the stereotype. Anytime the cops asked me questions, I started speaking in broken Afrikaans with a thick colored accent. Imagine a white guy in America, just dark enough to pass for Latino, walking around jail doing bad Mexican gangster dialogue from the movies. "Shit's about to get loco, ese." That's basically what I was doing. The South African version of that. This was my brilliant plan to survive incarceration. But it worked. The guys in the cell with me, they were there for drunk driving, for domestic abuse, for petty theft. They had no idea what real colored gangsters were like. Everyone left me alone. We were all playing a game, only nobody knew we were playing it. When I walked in that first night, everyone was giving me this look. "I'm dangerous. Don't fuck with me." So I went, shit, these people are hardened criminals. I shouldn't be here because I am not a criminal. Then, the next day, everything turned over quickly. One by one, guys left to go to their hearings. I stayed to wait for my lawyer, and new people started to pitch up. Now, I was the veteran, doing my colored gangster routine, giving the new guys the same look. "I'm dangerous. Don't fuck with me." And they looked at me and went, shit, he's a hardened criminal. I shouldn't be here because I'm not like him. And round we went. At a certain point, it occurred to me that every single person in that cell might be faking it. We were all decent guys from nice neighborhoods and good families, picked up for unpaid parking tickets and other infractions. We could have been having a great time, sharing meals, playing cards, and talking about women and soccer. But that didn't happen, because everyone had adopted this dangerous pose, and nobody talked because everyone was afraid of who the other guys were pretending to be. Now, those guys were going to get out and go home to their families and say, "Oh, honey, that was rough. Those were some real criminals in there. There was this one colored guy. Man, he was a killer." Once I had the game sorted out, I was good again. I relaxed. I was back to thinking, "I got this. This is no big deal." The food was actually decent. For breakfast, they brought you these peanut butter sandwiches on thick slices of bread. Lunch was chicken and rice. The tea was too hot, and it was more water than tea, but it was drinkable. They were older, hard-time prisoners close to parole, and their detail was to come and clean the cells and circulate books and magazines for you to read. It was quite relaxing. There was one point when I remember eating a meal and saying to myself, "This isn't so bad. I hang around with a bunch of dudes. There's no chores, no bills to pay. No one constantly nagging me and telling me what to do. Peanut butter sandwiches? Shit, I eat peanut butter sandwiches all the time. This is pretty sweet. I could do this." I was so afraid of the ass-whipping waiting for me at home that I genuinely considered going to prison. For a brief moment, I thought I had a plan. I'll go away for a couple of years, come back and say I was kidnapped, and Mom will never know and she'll just be happy to see me. On the third day, the cops brought in the largest man I had ever seen. This guy was huge, giant muscles, dark skin, hardened face. He looked like he could kill all of us. Me and the other prisoners who'd been acting tough with one another, the second he walked in, our tough guy routines were over. Everyone was terrified. We all stared at him. Oh, fuck. For whatever reason, this guy was half naked when the cops picked him up. He was wearing clothes the police had scrounged up for him at the station. This torn-up wife beater that was way too small. Pants so short on him they looked like capris. He looked like a black version of the Incredible Hulk. This guy went and sat alone in the corner. Nobody said a word. Everyone watched and waited, nervously, to see what he would do. Then, one of the cops came back and called the Hulk over. They needed information from him. The cops started asking him a bunch of questions, but the guy kept shaking his head and saying he didn't understand. The cop was speaking Zulu. The Hulk was speaking Tsonga. Black person to black person, and neither could understand the other. The Tower of Babel. Few people in South Africa speak Tsonga, but since my stepfather was Tsonga, I had picked it up along the way. I overheard the cop and the other guy going back and forth with nothing getting across, so I stepped in and translated for them and sorted everything out. Nelson Mandela once said, "If you talk to a man in a language he understands, that goes to his head. If you talk to him in his language, that goes to his heart." He was so right. When you make the effort to speak someone else's language, even if it's just basic phrases here and there, you are saying to them, "I understand that you have a culture and identity that exists beyond me. I see you as a human being." That is exactly what happened with the Hulk. The second I spoke to him, this face that had seemed so threatening and mean lit up with gratitude. "Ah, nakenza, nakenza, nakenza. Iwena mani. Mufana wa khaledi. Uishtiba kwini Xitsonga. Uhuma kwini. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Who are you? How does a colored guy know Tsonga? Where are you from?" Once we started talking, I realized he wasn't the Hulk at all. He was the sweetest man, a gentle giant, the biggest teddy bear in the world. He was simple, not educated. I'd assumed he was in for murder, for squashing a family to death with his bare hands, but it wasn't anything like that. He'd been arrested for shoplifting PlayStation games. He was out of work and needed money to send to his family back home, and when he saw how much these games sold for, he thought he could steal a few and sell them to white kids and make a lot of money. As soon as he told me that, I knew he wasn't some hardened criminal. I know the world of pirated things. Stolen